what's more interesting to me is you know, the Amazons of the world, the Netflixes of the world, who own their customer and can have an actual community of their own within their own walled garden. And obviously with Disney Plus launching yesterday, you see, like, they've openly said they are betting the future of the company on Disney Plus, on direct to consumer. And it's really a bigger deal than I think people are paying attention to, because in doing that, they are removing billions of dollars of revenue and profit associated by not selling their content to the Netflixes of the world, the Apple Pluses of the world, and instead trying to build their own.
That's Jason Stein, general partner of Steins & Co., an investment and advisory business focused on tech, consumer media, and certainly sports entertainment. Most recently, he built, sold, and ultimately exited Laundry Service, considered by Fast Company as one of America's most innovative companies, as well as his business cycle. He's a pro's pro. And we dig into the gap he saw in the marketplace via content creation and distribution, and how he grew that business on Craigslist. That's right, Craigslist. The conversation then examines shifts in the influencer marketplace, what he thinks of Kylie Jenner, transformational brands to watch, capitalizing on incoming deals, and marketplace trends, including streaming and direct-to-consumer.
I graduated NYU in 2006, and the real education of going to NYU, in my view, was not in the classroom, although I was a sports management major, which could be relevant for your podcast. I will say that is not what made me successful in sports. It was being in New York City and interning at a variety of different types of companies, from Neuberger Berman and working on their short sales desk, believe it or not, to running around the streets with cameras, HD cameras that were just becoming very accessible at that time, and making content. And what I realized was happening in the marketplace between social media and Facebook having recently launched, and the ability to create content with what eventually would be your phone, is the democratization of content creation and the democratization of content distribution. And my simple idea that I was thinking about, you know, at the time was, shouldn't there be a company that specializes in the creation and distribution of digital content? And people thought that that was absolutely crazy at that time. It certainly wasn't something that that agencies were thinking about, right? They in 2006 were very much still focused on TV spots and billboards. And the distribution side of it was the same, right? Like, nobody really foresaw the social platforms and digital platforms becoming the majority of where ad spend goes. And, you know, it's obvious today going into 2020, 14 years later, but even in 2014 or 2015, when I was, you know, 3 years into my business at Laundry Service and Cycle, it was still being questioned constantly. Mm-hmm. And if you go back and look, like, I had to write articles for CNBC and Facebook in 2012 and 2013, defending and explaining the value of mobile native feed ads, right? And you forget how recently that was. So that was the simple kernel of the business that obviously became something much bigger and won many awards and worked with the biggest brands and original content platforms in the world.
But what's interesting is that almost simple thesis. Bezos has got a great interview. It's floating around these days from 20 years ago. We're doing just analytics on the web, and he realized this 2,300% growth day to day of traffic on the internet. And obviously 20 years later, look what Amazon is. But what did you see when you talk about the use and the ability on this creation and distribution of content? Was there a particular moment, or just every day as someone in school or recently out of school, you're like, hang on a second, there's just a lot of this, but there's nothing to do with it?
The biggest moment for me wasn't on the content creation side, because that was a little bit more I would say obvious and overt, just in that everyone would be able to create really high quality content with devices that they carried on them every single day, right? The question was, what do you do with that content? And so we started, we got our first $1 million of revenue by, I applied to ads on Craigslist every day. And I would go in the TV film video section and reply to things like, need viral video for YouTube, need influencers for YouTube, need to understand how to use Facebook, right? And like, there were actually some like decent sized brands using Craigslist back in like 2011 to try and find people to help in this space. And so we would create content for them, and it was very good content, but they would put it on the internet, and it wouldn't necessarily go anywhere. So they would say, like, what do we do now? And in one particular case, and I still have this email saved, the email said, great video, it's next to a cat running into a wall on YouTube. And I still have that video. And it literally was just like, okay, like, I think it was a Foot Locker ad. And it had like 500 views after a day. And a cat running into a wall recorded in like a very grainy footage had like 25 million views, right? And so what became clear to me was the content was a commodity. Everybody would be able to create decent enough content that could do well across the internet. The question was, how do you get that content to the right people and make sure that it's something that they want to see? And so we got very good at the distribution of that content, using everything from paid media to influencers to direct to consumer, and working on, you know, the membership programs for companies like Nike or Beats by Dre.
To go back, because I'm fascinated on the Craigslist. So that was coming from a brand manager, a creative person in-house. Who was actually writing? I mean, there were briefs, almost RFPs on Craigslist?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, even agencies hired us. It was a wild time. So everything from like a head of marketing to a consultant to an agency was looking for talent in that way at that time. And obviously, you know, 95 out of 100 jobs you apply to, you don't even hear back from, right? And then 4 out of the remaining 5 are just BS or very strange opportunities that you probably don't want to do. And you can imagine the kind of stuff you get on Craigslist. And then 1 might be something that was real. But we absolutely got our first $1 million of revenue from jobs on Craigslist, and it's how we built the company.
And obviously a bigger company that is in the space doing this stuff has a network in finding the influencers or maybe access to physical locations for shoots. Curious, when you were just starting and figuring this out, how did you kind of navigate that ecosystem?
Well, when we were starting out, it wasn't really a thing yet, right? Like, there weren't companies doing it that well. I actually partnered with a woman named Liz Eswine. She owns the at New York City handle on Instagram, which has like 1.5 million followers. And she was very early and innovative in starting to sign influencers on Instagram as it was blowing up. So we brought her on, and she became the lead for our talent management and influencer business. And as one of the top influencers in the space, she was able to really scale that for us. And it was definitely a transformative moment for the company as we went from just creating content to ourselves to having a network around the world of the best content creators and who could also distribute that content and do it even more efficiently.
And then that business starts to go from 1 to 2 to 3 to 10, probably. You start creating good work, and at some point other brands take notice. At what point do you scale, and at what point do you say, hang on a second, maybe if we're acquired, we actually can get to an end goal here?
So I would say the most transformative moment, aside from, you know, launching that talent group, was definitely winning the Jordan brand account. And I've talked about this before, but as someone who spent most of his young adult life playing basketball, you know, in AAU all over the Tri-State area in New York City, playing at NYU, And having at the time, it was a social media agency. I just said to everyone, if we don't win this account, we just have to shut the whole thing down. Like we cannot not win this. And I've talked about this. I had photos of myself playing basketball throughout high school in Jordan sneakers in the opening slides of the pitch deck, just to show them how important this was for me. So I would say that was really important. To be honest with you, the end goal for me in starting the company was always to sell it. Like that was my end goal. I wanted to seize the opportunity around content creation and distribution that seemed to me as a really big white space, to build a great company and to help brands navigate that. But my personal goal was always to sell the business for as much money as I possibly could. And, you know, the services business, as you well know, and anyone who works in it knows, is a brutal business. It's not necessarily a fun business. I really enjoyed owning a company and building one and being innovative and setting a new direction for the content and advertising space overall. But my goal was once we got it to be big enough to sell it for what I felt was a very meaningful amount of money, my goal was achieved.
And as you're going through this process and sitting from afar, but part of the triangle with the brand and the influencer and this community, what brands outside of Jordan did you think really understood culture or had the opportunity to understand their consumer and fan base? And equally on the talent side, who do you, I don't say admire, but who do you look to that says they've really figured out their fan community and either have commercialized it really well or just engaged really well?
I would say Beats by Dre was always, to me, one of the best at being in tune with culture across sports and music and globally as well. And I think they did it as well as anyone. To be honest, I've gladly disconnected from that world, having left the businesses almost 2 years ago and focusing on my new businesses. Yep. So I'm admittedly not in the, you know, brand community social headspace as I once was. But what I can tell you is, you know, it's still the Nikes of the world who have you know, a core brand value and are focusing more on membership to build their community, right, directly with consumers rather than the social platforms that I feel from a business perspective are going to be best positioned going forward, right? So it's not about creating some content with the goal of some superficial interactions around the web, because that's going to happen from, you know, in the Nike case with the sneaker blogs and with the influencers, right? What's more interesting to me is you know, the Amazons of the world, the Netflixes of the world who own their customer and can have an actual community of their own within their own walled garden. And obviously with Disney Plus launching yesterday, you see, like, they've openly said they are betting the future of the company on Disney Plus, on direct-to-consumer. And it's really a bigger deal than I think people are paying attention to, because in doing that, they are removing billions of dollars of revenue and profit associated by not selling their content to the Netflixes of the world, the Apple Pluses of the world, and instead trying to build their own. So it's hugely risky, and I think it's the right move, because long term they do need to own their audience, right? Imagine if Disney World or any of their parks were not their own, and they didn't own the data, they didn't own the consumer, and they were just using someone else's park and putting a ride in it. You can imagine how much less of a company it would be. So I think it's the right move, but it's obviously a sea change in where this industry is going.
Yeah, interesting analogy to the part for sure. But, so take that part B though. Even though you're not living that world every day with what you're doing with Steins now, which we'll get into here in a second, but you're certainly on social and using it either just personally, professionally, do you see certain talent that have done a really nice job recently of creating their own media channels or standing for something and just standing out from other influencers in the market?
I think there are a lot of professional athletes who do a really good job with it. I think, on the influencer side, it's the talent that has some kind of actual talent or some kind of business around them that, to me, really stand out. Like, a Kylie Jenner with her lip kit brand. That she went from just being an influencer for the sake of being an influencer, which, it was interesting, to being an influencer with a platform, with a purpose, with a point of view, and became a billionaire, one of the youngest self-made billionaires ever, because it was more than just an influencer for the sake of influencer. And I think that is the biggest shift you have to make if that's the space you want to be in, right? Like, having a lot of followers is not a great business by itself. It's a media company. And as we know, media is not a great business to be in, generally speaking, especially if it's just, a third-party platform that you're renting your audience on. I think it's the people who are taking that, like the fat Jewish kid with his Babe Rosé that he sold to AB InBev, and taking your values and your point of view and your audience and turning it into some direct-to-consumer business or brand.
And that you referenced it earlier with, we'll call it phase two of work and Steins, and I'm not sure it's a fund, but it's certainly some capital that you have, and maybe from others, you can tell me here, that you're deploying into companies. What are you looking for? What's that gap that you noticed 10 years ago that you're trying to examine and maybe invest in now?
Yeah, so the one thing I knew I wanted to do when I left Laundry Service and Cycle was start investing. I had run a VC fund on the side throughout the entire time for a handful of partners from Renaissance Technologies, which is the top quant fund in the world. And it was a bunch of mathematicians, and we did early stage enterprise technology. And had some nice exits, relatively quickly there. And I enjoyed the investing space, but I also really liked operating. So I just wanted a platform that I could make or capitalize on all the inbound deal flow I was seeing because of the success I had had, and then be able to go and help scale those companies, work with those entrepreneurs to grow. And so I set up Steins Co. to do that. And I use a lot of my own money. We raise money from outside partners on a deal by deal basis for that business. We also take a very active role in advisory capacities in the company we're working with, and sometimes outside of those portfolio companies. I think that's part one of where I'm focusing my attention. We've done a handful of great deals. Probably the most relevant for your audience is Front Office Sports, where we have a very meaningful part of that business and work with Adam White, who's one of the best entrepreneurs I've worked with, who's the founder and CEO in building what I believe is the future of the sports business, media and publication. That they've really made a huge dent, and their readership is on par with any of the biggest sports business platforms that there are. That said, when I left, I also knew that I would want to do many things. And what's become clear now is that a lot of the focus for what we're doing is in the sports and entertainment space. And Front Office is one example. And we have a couple of really big, really exciting deals we'll be announcing later this year, early in 2020, in the space. And what we're planning on doing is creating a sports and entertainment focused holding company investment platform for those assets, so that we can separate them from early stage technology or other real estate investments that we're doing through Steins Co.
And but, yeah, keep going. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, you know, sports and entertainment space is so exciting to me because it combines the two biggest trends for the consumer internet today, which I view as the streaming wars, right? Tens of billions of dollars being spent by the biggest tech companies in the world, from Apple to Amazon to AT&T to Netflix, you know, annually on original content, and eventually on live sports, which will make those budgets go up even more, right? So you have the streaming wars on one hand, where sports and entertainment are going to drive most of the value. And then you have direct to consumer, right? Which is quickly, you know, becoming a huge backbone of the consumer internet. And look no further than Shopify's stock to understand both the, you know, the big boys and the long tail going direct to consumer.
How hard is it for you from creating a business and having hundreds of employees to being a investor and advisor where you can provide input, but there's a CEO somewhere that's actually running the business that you don't get to? Is that a challenge for you?
It's a great question, and it's definitely a I'll call it a transition more than a challenge, and it was definitely a big adjustment that I had to make because you go from spending, you know, all day, every day for many years, being the person who has to not just come up with the strategy, but also supervise the, you know, the execution of that vision, right? But admittedly, what I was hoping to get out of was having to be the person who did every bit of handling that execution. Of course, you delegate to great people, and we had amazing people working with us at Laundry Service and Cycle and Wasserman. And we could have been successful without them, but it's still the buck stops at you at the end of the day, and you have to be the one to make sure it gets done right. So I was excited to be able to be very, you know, germane to the vision and strategy of a business and even the infrastructure and how it's set up for execution, but then hand it off to people like Adam White at Front Office Sports, to or any of our other entrepreneurs who can then go do the really, really hard part, which is the execution. I mean, for in my view, the vision is relatively easy. Of course, you have to get it right, and that's not easy for everyone, but it's much more grueling and painstaking to do the execution because it's, you know, either success or death by a thousand cuts, right? You have to just keep grinding and keep grinding and keep tweaking and keep going and get a step back, two steps forward, one step back every step of the way, as you well know. So I was happy and I'm happy doing that. You know, in our bigger stakes and our bigger assets, I do take on a bit of an operational role and just because I've done it before and I can help guide that success. But it's way less than it was, previously. And, you know, for me, I think that's a better use of time and a better way to scale a skill set, right? If you can, you know, scale your time across many companies and make the biggest impact you can, and then let other people focus on execution, it's a much more scalable industry, right? If you think about it, like finance is a good industry because if you manage $100 million and you're, you know, investing it in, call it in stocks, or you manage $1 billion or you manage $100 billion, right? It doesn't take more work to invest more money into the same stocks, right? You have a strategy and you deploy that capital into them and you make more money, but you don't necessarily do more work. And that's the ultimate definition of scalability, right? In, you know, if you were an operator or you're running, call it a, you know, an agency or a media company or a tech company, you have to be there and only there, and you have to actually spend more time and more money to get more business or to do more work. And to me, that's the fundamental difference. And it's certainly a big adjustment, but I believe a better long-term business. Mm.
And going back to your trends you mentioned just of streaming and direct to consumer, talk, let's hear on competitive gaming and esports. Do you think in your mind, when does that business really become transformative in the United States? Is that 1 year, 5 years, 10 years?
I think it's right now, and will grow over that time horizon. But if you look at the way that whether it's NBA 2K or Fortnite or League of Legends or any of these really, really popular games are transforming the way people spend their time with entertainment and interactive experiences, there's no question that it's going to take a ton of attention away from the streaming services. And it's probably the biggest competitor. I think Netflix even said Fortnite was its biggest competitor. Because of how much time is being spent on it in deeply, deeply engaged ways, right? Whereas, you know, if you're on Twitter on your phone, you're still watching Netflix probably. If you're playing a video game, that's the only thing you're doing at that time. So I do believe that it's going to be a huge piece of this puzzle and is maybe being overlooked in some capacities in regard to the streaming wars direct to consumer businesses.
Is that gaming in general, or is that specific to competitive and esports? I feel like people have forgotten about just gaming in general. We talk so much about teams and leagues of Overwatch and League of Legends and Riot, etc., that the amount of people that are just simply gaming, sitting by themselves, the 9-year-old playing by themselves for fun. So it's more, I guess, for sure it's now. I totally agree with you. I'm wondering, on the competitive side, do you think the competitive side is transformative now too? Or is that a little bit, I guess, longer tail?
I think it's gaming in general. Yeah. And I don't know exactly where you draw the line between them. But a great example is NBA 2K, right? They have the NBA 2K League, which is a really interesting experiment from the NBA and has certainly made an impact and been successful in some ways. But then you also have NBA 2K, the game itself, and where all these kids are spending their time is actually not only or even not as much with the 2K League so much as it is with the biggest 2K influencers and content creators who play the game are as good or better than the people in the league. And what's happening is like two of the top creators will they'll go online night and play each other, and they'll bet $5,000 on like a 2-on-2 game in the park in 2K. So not even necessarily within, it's just their avatars. It's not even within the NBA teams or game itself. It's in the 2K park, and they'll play each other, and they'll get a huge, huge audience, and they're actually gambling on that game. And so to answer the other part of your question of like what can transform gaming and competitive gaming even more is when legalized gambling becomes a piece of that, because now you're playing your own, you're playing for money, and you actually are the player too.
Yeah, my personal shift in noticing that in my family is, when I grew up, and probably when you grew up a bit, you got your stats from the newspaper the next morning. My 16-year-old got the stats watching ESPN, right, when they woke up on the scroll. And my 9-year-old jumps in my bed now in the morning with late-night NBA scores because of what they saw scrolling on NBA 2K before they've even gotten to a TV.
Oh, wow, that's crazy. Yeah, my son recently, as of like 2 weeks ago, started waking up and watching SportsCenter at 5 a.m. in the living room, which is a blessing and a curse because, it's like I used to do that and it's exciting for me to see him doing that. But B, like I can never say no to sitting on the couch watching SportsCenter with him. So there's a lot of very early mornings now watching highlights over and over again.
And you'll see when he gets a little older than five, when he's borrowing your phone in the morning and he's just now crawled into bed with you and just scrolling through it. And
amazing.
Yeah. So kind of closing here on the future of investment and Steins Co. and just business and trends in general. Are you more optimistic than ever? Are you, from a trend line, as optimistic as you were a year ago, or where are you in that kind of 1 to 10 of what the future looks like in this industry?
Yeah, so I'll take it in a few parts. You know, like I said, I do believe in sports and entertainment as an area that will be very healthy in the near term and the long term. So I expect that we'll spin off sports and entertainment as a separate platform from our tech and other types of asset classes. And generally, I'm an optimistic person. I think you are more successful when you are generally a bull than a bear, because in the end, things are generally more bullish than bearish. If you just look at it as an example, the stock market over a long-term period, right? Every 30 years, if you're invested broadly in the market, you're going to 10x your money approximately. And that's been the case for a long time and likely will continue. And, you know, I think you have to always balance optimism and belief in what you're doing with the future with you know, a healthy amount of reality. And so you don't get caught with your pants down. And certainly I'm not, you know, someone who would want to be as audacious as, you know, SoftBank or WeWork was, right? Because that's how you get yourself in trouble. But, you know, excluding the fact that we've been in a very long bull market, probably one of the historically positive trend, you know, I do believe that there's many, many areas of business, particularly in sports and entertainment, particularly in streaming and direct to consumer, and the convergence of those two areas that I feel great about the future of sports and entertainment, right? Like content rights and sports rights and, you know, great original programming, the value is only increasing, right? Certainly when Facebook and Amazon and Netflix and Apple and Google are bidding for the same rights that the networks were all bidding for in sports, the value will go up simply because the size of the companies bidding on them is astronomically larger than it was last time these rights all came up. So that'll be a huge inflection point in the early to mid 2020s. So I'm excited. I feel good about where the world is going. I think tech and VC as an asset class is challenged right now. And that's not a surprise. It's been well documented in the press. And I think there'll be a correction, which will create a new opportunity to invest in it. And I would say I'm excited about the future. But that's how I feel. I try to wake up and feel that way every day because life is short. And as you and I have discussed off the podcast, you got to enjoy your time, make the most of it while you can.
And that's The Bond. There's plenty more to come.